what triggered this bizarre behavior.
Journey into the cold heart of Northern Darkness with Nordic Crimes.
That case became like a scene from a horror movie.
A new true crime documentary series that chilled the bone.
The hunger for killing is increasing in the course of these homicides.
Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Nordic Crimes is a part of the Acast family.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and welcome back to 1 Minute Remaining. My name is Jack Lawrence, the host and creator of this show. Today is part 7 of the story of the Cain brothers, Jeremy and Zachary, two boys who were convicted of murder in 2002, along with Mark Harper, two teens who said they were merely trying to defend themselves from a man who was attacking them, two teens who are now men who have grown up behind prison walls. In our previous episode, we started to look at the accounts of one of the prosecution's main witnesses, Paul Gillian, a corrections officer who lived opposite where this incident took place that afternoon. His initial statement was just two sentences long and really didn't give much detail as to what happened. He would be called to the police station that afternoon, in fact, just an hour after this incident had taken place. It was after the boys had arrived to tell police what had happened, and Mr. Gillian was asked to identify them. On that day, he would say that Jeremy hit Mr. Hill twice, once in the leg and once in the head. He didn't believe Zach had hit a victim at all, and he didn't recognise Mark Harper.
Gillian, his statement changed two or three times. I'm not sure exactly how, I just know they changed. I know they got longer because I'm sitting there like, it's like he couldn't even identify us at first. When he came to line up, he couldn't point none of us out. He looked me dead in my face, like in my face, with a gun, and he couldn't identify me in the city jail. But then you turn around and you pointed all of us out in the courtroom. Like, how did you see? And then he says he's seen everything looking out a window. But if you listen to the 911 tape, which is gruesome, you don't really, I mean, it just sounds horrible. But when you listen to it, he's talking, he's looking out the window. His wife's on the other end looking out the window. They go running upstairs and downstairs to come out the front door. And on the way, he stops, I guess he grabs a gun. By the time he gets outside, my brother has already got Mark up, and you hear his truck revving up like he's about to leave. So how did you see anything? If you've seen everything that happened, by the time you ran, you've seen it. They're out there in the things with bats and sticks. Something's going on. Okay, he takes off running. By the time he gets outside, my brother, it's over with. I'm the only one still standing there stuck. You know, and Mark's sitting in his car looking just in shock, like he don't even know what to do. And I get in the car and tell him, man, drive, just go to your house. And I call my mom on the phone, you know, and like, how did you see anything? How did the witness see anything? You know, I don't get it.
45 days later at Zachary's juvenile hearing, his memory of the events would change. Although he would state that it wasn't in fact his memory that had changed, but the original police report that was incorrect. He says that it was not Jeremy who hit Mr. Hill, but the opposite, and was in fact Zach. Almost 1 year later, Mr. Gillian would be called back to court, and this time it would be to testify at the boys' murder trial. Whereas in the first three statements about the events, he would tell police and the court who struck Mr. Hill and how many times, identifying the boys by name. However, at this point during his testimony with the prosecution, there is no mention of names at all, merely referring to the boys as the teenagers or juveniles, like here.
I seen one of the juveniles take a bat and give him the stick away from the other juvenile.
And this is how that moment was originally described in the police report from just an hour after the incident.
Witness 1 stated that he recognized subject Zach Kane as the one holding the bat that Jeremy Kane took out of his hands. Witness 1 stated that he does not think subject Zach Kane struck any blows to the victim.
Upon cross-examination, the defense attorney would press Mr. Gillian on his recollection of what boy did what to Mr. Hill and how many times. I guess people have asked you, Mr. Gillian, to try to be specific about who struck whom. They have done that, haven't they? No, sir. Well, you have been specific about who hit whom or where, haven't you? Yes, sir. Is it fair to say, Mr. Gillian, though, that the more you think about it, the more you're not sure who hit who? When they started swinging, everybody was swinging. I don't know who hit who. The boys and their families have been so confused as to why Mr. Gillian might say things that they don't believe to be true while up on the stand, and why his eyewitness account would change so many times, that one afternoon Jeremy's wife and cousin would in fact decide to go and visit Mr. Gillian at his home.
So yeah, it was 2017 after they were set off for on parole, and I was really nervous. I'm not a private investigator.
No, of course. When did you make the decision to do this? Like, did you already have this in your mind that you wanted to do it, or, you know, did someone suggest it? How did the idea come up to actually go around and just, like, knock on the door?
You know, it was kind of Jeremy's idea. You know, we were just kind of grasping at straws. Hey, let's just go talk to these people and see if they'll be willing to talk or help or, I mean, and so that's just me and his cousin Stephanie got together and went over there and knocked on the door and he invited us in.
So Jeremy's wife and cousin turn up at Mr. Gillian's home unannounced and not quite sure about what reception, if any, they might get. They switch on a camera and make their way up to the drive. So, I mean, walking up that driveway, I mean, you must have had your heart in your throat.
Yeah, and he was kind of out in the middle of nowhere, so we just crossed our fingers and...
As they stand and wait, all of a sudden, the door opens.
Hey, how are you?
Hi.
Hey.
And there he stands.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Stephanie.
Mr. Paul Gillian.
Oh, hey.
Hey.
A much older gentleman than the one that jumped from his porch that day to intervene in a confrontation that took place in front of his home. The two ladies tell him why they are there, and to their amazement, he invites them in to his home to talk.
Mr. Gillian?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Stephanie, and this is Amanda.
Oh, hey.
Hey.
Great to meet you.
I think we just want to talk to you if you had a minute.
Sure.
We're friends with the Kane family from Pleasant Grove. It's been a long time.
Yeah. Probably you. Y'all want to come in?
Sure.
Sure.
Oh, okay.
Apologize for just popping up on you, but...
Oh, well, that's okay.
And luckily he was very nice to us and let us come into the house and he talked to us for a little bit, so...
The three all sit down in his living room and he tells them his wife is out at church as they begin chatting about this and that. The two ladies, obviously still quite shocked that they've even got in the front door, do their best to broach the subject of that day, being very careful about what they say and how they say it. Mr. Gillian, during the entire conversation, is obviously still saddened by the events and how it all played out. He continues to offer any help he can for the boys, not even realising that they are still in prison.
If you find anything that would get, you know, if somebody remembered something or said, hey, I didn't see it all or whatever... You know, then we could maybe get them some help.
Yeah.
Because it's all politics.
Well, see, I heard them out there fussing and cussing and first one thing and another, and I thought, oh, Lord, what's going on? And I was surfing the TV in the bedroom, and I went out there on the porch in the balcony, And I said, Lord have mercy. And, but yeah, all of them had crazy ball bats like a fool. But yeah, I thought they'd already be out. Seriously.
As we know, Mr. Gillian was actually a prison officer at the Young Offenders Institution where Zach would eventually be held. He brings that up in conversation with the ladies.
If there's any way I can help.
Well, you know, I appreciate you so much. Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, anything.
Well, we appreciate
it. No problem. I mean, I had that little, Eric, what was his name? The youngest one?
Yeah,
I had
Zach.
I had him at youth.
But he was scared to death.
No, my boss told me to stay away from him. So I.
Oh, yeah. That was
a conflict of interest.
Yeah. I tried. Lord, mercy.
Zach talked me through the moment that he and Mr. Gillian would actually come face to face at the Young Offenders Institution after he'd been arrested.
I mean, just him just shaking his head. And I mean, he said some stuff. I can't remember what exactly it was. It was just pretty much like he was feeling bad. That's the way it looked to me, the way he was talking. I told him I couldn't talk to him.
Yeah.
But he was saying some stuff about, you know, just feeling bad about the situation and us being like, it seemed like he felt bad about us being locked up. It's like he felt like, the way he looked, it made it look like his hands were tied. Like he couldn't, I don't know. It just seemed like he couldn't tell the truth.
Eventually, as the conversation continues, the ladies tentatively bring up the timber that the boys have always said that Mr. Hill had in his hands.
I guess that's all we got to say.
Unfortunate situation. Seeing if there was anything that you could remember that could maybe help.
No, not really.
I mean, but you really didn't see everything. If you, by the time you got out there, they already had the bats and stuff. Did you see him with the landscape timber too, or was that already gone?
Mr. Gillian, as we know, has always said that Jimmy Hill, from his point of view, never had a weapon that day. At no point did he ever see Mr. Hill carrying any weapon whatsoever. However, during this conversation, he says the following.
No, it was already gone.
He had a landscape timber when he came down the road.
Yeah, he had a... Ugh, it looked like a 4x4.
Yeah, I heard. But then they went back. The police couldn't find it. Yeah.
But then he says in a statement, like, up there on the stand, I think he said that the man didn't have a weapon. But then he turns around and tells my brother's wife and finally admitted that the dude had a stick.
Yeah, I heard that.
They got him on recording saying that.
When he said that, did you kind of go, I mean, you must have been, your head's been going, oh, my God, he's just admitting that he's seen this thing, and he said on the stand that he never saw a thing.
Yes, but how, I mean, I'm just not really good with that, so I didn't kind of want to pry too much, but then at the same time, you want more questions, but then you just kind of want to keep him talking, and you know, Stephanie did most of the talking. You know, I was ready to get out of there. I was like, oh, what's your phone number? Okay, thanks. So luckily, she kind of kept the conversation rolling.
Now, does this instantly mean that Mr. Gillian has been lying this whole time? Not necessarily. Of course, he could be just confused. All this information is well and truly out in the sphere. He would have watched a lot of news reports. He would have spoken about this event so many times, and he could just be confused. The conversation continued to go back and forth with no real major moments of sudden omissions of saying that he was told to say certain things. In fact, to be fair, the ladies ask him outright if the DA ever asked him to say something that he didn't in fact see, and he says no.
Hey, let me ask you what I was thinking. I know when the DA, you know, talked to you and stuff, did they tell you certain, do you remember them telling you to say certain things or anything like that?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No.
I mean, none of them are even down there. Most of them are dead anyway. None of them are down there anymore.
Yeah.
I didn't know if they, like, you know,
No.
Yeah.
That is until the conversation is coming to an end, outside of his home. The three are all on the front porch, again, just exchanging pleasantries, Mr. Gillian talking about a new home they're moving to, his family who live nearby, and then again, offers any assistance he can, and says this.
But yeah, like I said, I mean, God, I wouldn't even think about going and being in a place like that. But anyway, I can help them shoot, just let me know.
Well,
I'll have to perjure myself of all of them.
No, that's the thing about, I'm so glad you brought that up. Perjury is, it's already over. We've looked it up and the lawyers told us. Yeah. After 5 or 6
The biggest question is why Mr. Gillian would be concerned about perjuring himself. Perjury is the act of lying on the stand while under oath. So unless he said something on the stand that was not true, then there should be no reason for him to be concerned over perjury. The family have since tried to speak with him again, but this time were confronted with a rather angry Mrs. Gillian, who, in no uncertain terms, told them to leave him alone and he would not be speaking with them again. You spoke to her afterwards and she wasn't very accommodating, shall we say.
He said he could help, let him know what he could help us with, and gave us his phone number. And I called him the next day and she answered, and she was pretty straightforward with me to leave them alone and not to bother them. And he didn't lie then, and he's not going to lie now.
Hi, is Paul there?
Who's calling?
This is Amanda. I spoke with him yesterday.
Right. What did he tell you yesterday?
Is this Virginia?
It is.
It is. Hey, I was just calling him back. He talked to us yesterday and said he was willing to help us out with anything that he could, and so we were just going to see if there was a better time that we could come and speak to the both of you.
Well, let's put it like this. Like he told you yesterday, he didn't lie before. He's not going to lie now. He told the truth then. He will tell the truth now. Look, lady, do you know what y'all have done to us mentally with all this? All this in the back of our minds. We have thrown all that away. We don't want to help out. We don't want to do anything. Please leave us alone.
Okay, we will do that.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
As we know from each of the boys, they have all stated that Chris Stano, the other teen who was in Jeremy's truck that day, would lie on the stand in order to have his own murder charge severely downgraded, which of course it is. As I was reading through page after page of paperwork on this case, I would come across a couple of handwritten statements. Statements made by two young guys at the time, one by the name of Eric and the other called Justin. Hello, is that Justin?
It is.
Justin, this is Jack Lawrence, the journalist in Australia, doing the story on the Cain brothers.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, sir. I hope it's not too late calling you. I do apologise.
No, it's
Justin is a cousin of the Cain brothers. Both Eric and Justin's statements speak of a night when they were waiting in a parking lot of Oak Mountain Amphitheatre before heading into a concert. They were sitting on the back of a truck with another guy called Tyler. As they're chatting, Justin would ask Tyler, who was a friend of Chris Stano's, if he'd spoken to him lately, which he had. Justin then asks him what he thinks about Chris's lying on the stand. There was a written statement that was made, very short one, in regards to the Chris Stano situation. Do you remember that much?
I mean, it was written a long, long time ago, but pretty much in a nutshell, me and another friend of ours and a guy named Tyler was sitting on a tailgate getting ready to go to a concert. And I asked him, you know, they were friends and everything, and I asked him, you know, if he talked to Chris Stano. And he said, yeah, he said that he had talked to him. I said, well, did he tell you anything about him lying on the stand? And he said, yes, that the DA had told him what to say and, you know, how to say it and everything. I guess so he wouldn't get in trouble. And, you know, we talked a little bit longer, and then that was the end of the conversation.
How old were you, do you think, when this conversation were had? Obviously, it was a long time ago. How old were you been?
I guess I'd have been around 20. I was between 18 and 20 years old.
And was this around the time the boys had been convicted?
Yes, it would have been right after they were convicted, I'm sure.
Yeah. Was it quite a known thing that Chris maybe had lied on the stand? I mean, you know, you said you were sitting on the tailgate chatting and it was sort of brought up, hey, you know, have you spoken to him about why he lied? So was it a kind of a known thing that he may not have told the truth?
Well, I mean, we knew about it because, I mean, we, you know, knew what the boys had said, and their stories hadn't changed very little, if any, since day one. Mm. And then he gets on the stand, and of course I wasn't in there. They didn't know if they was me to testify or not. But anyway, he gets on the stand and, you know, starts saying stuff that, you know, didn't happen.
So after that conversation, did you tell your family what had been said?
Yeah, I told my Uncle Steve, which is Zach and Jeremy's dad.
Yeah.
And he wanted me to write a statement down. So I made a statement and wrote it down and gave it to him.
And I'm assuming that's the last really you probably ever heard about it.
Yeah, pretty much. That was the last I heard about it.
And you weren't friends with Chris Stano at all, or it was just that he was a friend of a friend?
Yeah, I mean, he was just, we'd always be places and he'd always be there. I didn't really have a problem with him or anything. He seemed nice enough.
Yeah.
See, we played park ball growing up, so pretty much all the boys in Pleasant Grove from a certain age group, we all played baseball.
Yeah.
So you might be on somebody's team this year and then somebody else's team next year, so it was all real. Everybody knew everybody in this small town.
Sure. So the trial would run its course and eventually the jury returned their verdict. Here's Jeremy. So how long did your trial last for?
2 days jury selection and 5 days for the trial. On the last day, they were going to continue to either make them the jury stay for the weekend or continue until Monday. You've got like an hour to make a decision or we're going to bring you back. So they just went in there and made a decision and you know, he pretty much forced them to make a decision.
So they only went out for an hour and they came back?
Yeah, it's something. I think they had went out for like an hour or so and then they come back with some questions, and the questions the judge couldn't answer as far as like, well, you know, they wanted some more information about, well, what made the man do this or what did, and they, you know, the stuff the judge feeds, you just got to go off what you heard and I can't, you know, give any more details or whatever. And then I think at that time they told them, well, you know, it's getting late in the afternoon. Got to make a decision by, you know, the next hour or two or whatever time you gave them, then we'd be bringing you back. I don't know if he said for the weekend or for Monday. I know he basically told him, if y'all don't come up with a decision today, you're coming back until you make a decision. So pretty much made them make a decision.
So they come back, and obviously they find you guys guilty of the crime.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been pretty hard to hear as a young bloke. I mean, it'd be hard for anyone, but as a, you know, as a kid, it must be extremely
hard. Yeah, and I also know that some of the jurors were, I mean, I remember I was crying. I know some of the jurors were crying also. And I know an investigator talked with them after the fact, and some of the jurors stated that they were under the impression that we were getting some type of view for offender and probation because we were juveniles like the other kids got. They didn't realize that we were going to adult prison. And, you know, that goes into the fact, you know, like how they kind of preyed on the jurors. They used people that were, you know, I mean, less educated in the system, didn't understand what was going on, and did not realize that we were actually being considered as adults. They thought we were kids. And we'd get like a lesser sentence. They thought we should have got punished, but not to the extreme of what we got.
It was never ever spoken about at trial that you were being tried as adults and would be going to adult prison.
I don't remember for sure if that was actually explained. I know it wasn't explained in the way they understood it. I think it was one of the situations where they just expected them to understand it. I don't think it was ever said that we would be going to adult prison or none of that. I don't believe so, no.
Here's Zach talking about being found guilty. Did you still have some hope that everything would be fine at the end of the day and that you would be found obviously not guilty and that this was self-defense?
Yes. I never thought I was going to prison, not in my wildest dreams. You know, the lawyers are really stroking your mind and ego to make you feel like, oh, everything's going to be fine. It's going to work out just fine. But if we would have listened to the first lawyer, which told us, our first lawyer had David Cromwell Johnson, he told us he couldn't take the case to trial because it was too much publicity. If there was no publicity, oh, he could get us off. But the publicity is what got us in prison. So he dropped the case. He told us, but the next lawyer we get, oh, I'm going to fight it. I'm gonna get it. We're going to beat this. And I'm like, really? So when they go to deliberate and they come back out quick, he said, it's good news. It's good news. They came back out fast. It's good news. I said, no, it's not. I sat there and told him, I said, no, it's not. He was like, he said, watch. I said, no, it's not. It's not good news. Guilty. So he's like, well, we're going to talk to him about sentencing. When he comes to sentencing, he files a motion to have the lesser sentence from 20 years to 10 years. Okay. I tell him that's not a good thing, because he granted it too fast. The judge granted it too fast. He said, that's a good thing. That means he's going to give you lesser time. I said, no, it doesn't. It means he already knew what he was going to give us, so it didn't matter if he granted it anyway.
Yeah.
So he grants it, and we get 35 years. Then the lawyer wants to tell me that I'll be here for the appeals and all this stuff. When you get another check, you know, when you get more money, when you want more money, you're going to be there for me. Come on, you ain't there for me. You don't care about me.
Here's Mark. So do you remember the day that the jury came back to find you guys guilty?
Yeah, we had adjourned from the juror around like 2:30, something like that. And so like we go outside and, you know, we're standing there and, you know, they say if the verdict don't come back before 5 or 6 or something like that, then we'll come back on Monday. So it was like not much longer left. And then they said, oh, the jury came back. Well, my lawyer was thinking that's a good thing. You know, we all go back in. I'm nervous as shit, you know. And, you know, they read that, you know, mine all first. You're going to find Mark Herbert and the Senate guilty. And then the whole courtroom went crazy. And I kind of lowered my head, like, because if, you know, no, I'm guilty, you know, they guilty. And I think Jeremy or Zach, one of them flopped in the floor, one of them fell in my lap, and I'm, you know, I'm kind of just in awe about everything. And I figured I would have got life, you know, in there, but went to sentencing. It was like 6 weeks later. The judge, He approved a petition for my sentence to be 10 to life instead of 20 to life. Everybody put in that motion, and I'm the only one that got accepted. So my lawyer's like, look, if you get 10, if you get 15, right? Like, you could get good time as long as you're good. You could be out 3.5, 4 years, you know. Now the judge is deciding, and he's, you know, slamming my sentence down. And when he said 35, you know, I've lost, from that point, you know, I lost hope in everything.
As we've spoken about in the past, this situation, like many others, leaves a trail of devastation behind it. Of course, there's the victim and the victim's family. And also, three teenagers who are off to prison leave behind their own families. The parents of these teenagers now having to see their children carted off to a violent institution where anything could happen to them. Here's Mr. Kane, the boy's father. They'll be in the entire time these guys have been in prison. I mean, it's a prison sentence for you guys as well.
You know, it's been a tough road. You know, the first few weeks of this thing, it was like a phone call every 5 minutes. And you know, those phone calls are not cheap.
Yeah.
Some of my phone bills when it first happened was up in the thousands of dollars. I mean, if you can imagine, two kids, 15 and 16, getting put in county jail or whatever, and they're screaming their heads off and everything else. And they didn't really want to ever go to prison, you know, but they finally wound up in prison. After they got in prison, they basically liked it a lot better in county jail. But, you know, it still wasn't no picnic place, I can tell you that. I'm sure, I don't know what happened, but I know it couldn't have been, you know, easy for a 15 and a 16-year-old or 17 or 18 or however it was that transfer to go to prison. It's just a horror story that nobody should ever have to face for a lie. I mean, you know, if you actually did what they said they did, I wouldn't even have paid for a lawyer. I mean, if my kids done something like that and I thought they deliberately went out and killed somebody, that's just their bad luck. They're going to jail. They're going to serve their time. But that's not the case.
You have 1 minute remaining.
And that's all we have time for. But coming up in our next episode, three teenagers are off to prison. They're not going to a facility with other youngsters. They're being sent to men's facilities. And they're not going to be segregated from the other inmates. They are told, point blank, by the people that run the prison, they will have no option but to fight for their survival.
And the warden called me up front and said, all I want you to do is fight. He told me, he said, I want you to fight. He said, you're the youngest kid in my prison, ever been in one of my prisons. He said, I want you to fight. And he said, you're not going to get in trouble.
And it was basically the same thing. I mean, they expected you to fight. I mean, they wanted you to. If you didn't, then they knew that you were not going to do very well.
Next time on 1 Minute Remaining. 1 Minute Remaining is a Mashed Pumpkin production, created, hosted, and produced by Jack Lawrence. Audio and sound design by Jack Lawrence and Dom Evans of Earsay.